Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, it's lovely Laura here, and you are listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody, and welcome to another episode in the third season of our House Culture podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor of House Culture, Matt Rouse. I hope that wherever you are listening in the world right now, you are staying safe, remaining positive, and looking forward to hopefully getting your dance floor groove on very soon. Thanks for tuning in today, and if it's your first time here, welcome. We are House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Not only can you enjoy our daily output of positive vibes on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, you can also dig into our hefty back catalogue of previous guests on the podcast. I'm talking about iconic DJs such as Fatboy Slim, David Morales, and Danny Tenaglia, as well as leaders of the new school of talent like Alan Fitzpatrick, Anya Schneider, and Josh Butler. Whatever your era is, we've got you covered. But our conversations don't just stop there. As we are House Culture, we like to investigate every element of the scene. And that is why we have also spoken to people like Manumission founding member and Pikes Hotel creative director Dawn Hindle, party-starting percussionist Bongo Ben, and one half of the legendary house music outfit, a man called Adam, Sally Rogers. Honestly, if you don't recognise the name, have a listen, as we handpick all of our guests to make sure they have a fascinating story to tell. Now, are you ready for this one? You might have seen the viral videos, you may have heard her on some house music bangers, you might also have even been lucky enough to witness her play live. She brings the good time vibe whenever she appears on stage and never fails to entertain. It is, of course, the one and only Lovely Laura. In this conversation, you'll hear how a chance meeting with a fellow musician led to a wild first trip to the White Isle.
It turned out this guy was Pav. He said, I've spoken to the Manumission guys. You can get up and have a play with me on the stage. I do remember getting up on the stage and my jaw just hitting the floor. I saw things that night that I was like, wow, this is crazy.
How a one-off event led to the formation of one of the most enduring duos in the scene.
It was a private event at a villa party in Ibiza. And they said, look, Ben, you could play. And Laura, if you could just play some saxophone. And it really worked. That was the beginning where we thought, gosh, we could do this together.
And you'll hear Laura's thoughts about performing live and our hopes for the future.
There is nothing like being in the room with the crowd and high-fiving them and seeing the joy on their faces and seeing them smile, seeing them laugh, seeing them cry sometimes, singing at the top of their voices, arms in the air. I really can't wait for that to come back.
Recorded live and direct from our base in Ibiza, I really hope you enjoy this one. This is Lovely Laura.
House Culture.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for sitting down with us on the podcast today. It's been a long time coming, but hopefully we can have a chat that's as full as the positive energy as one of your live sets. You're a sax sensation who has played to hundreds of thousands of club goers the world over. And working alongside your husband, DJ Ben Santiago, you form a dynamic duo that is truly unique within the scene. However, let's start at the beginning. And growing up in Dorset, how would you say you first discovered music, any music there when you were growing up?
Rewind. I was actually quite fortunate. I grew up in quite a musical family from both sides. My mum's father was, he actually had a band during the war, like a big band, like a jazz band. So he was a pianist, which was great. So when I was a little girl, I used to go around and jam with him on the piano. I mean, obviously I didn't know I was jamming at the time, but he would just encourage me to tinkle on the top. And that was great fun. So I think I had that. Plus my parents, well, my dad's side is very musical. My dad actually plays the piano. Mm-hmm. And his sister, my auntie's also she was like the organist in the church and mm-hmm. whatnot. So yeah, I was quite fortunate. It came from both sides. And my parents always listened to jazz. Okay. They love jazz. Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, saxophonist Dan Getz, Paul Desmond. Mm-hmm. So I grew up listening to jazz. That was pretty much, and I loved it. Apparently, my mum says one of her first memories of me when she realised that music was going to probably be a part of my life was when I was listening to Ella Fitzgerald. Apparently, I was sat on the floor. I think I was only about three or four, she said, and you were just in this trance. She said you were sat on the floor and you were doing this funny thing with your hands and your feet. And she said we'd walk in front of you as always to go, "Hello, Earth to Laura." She said, and you just weren't there. You were actually singing with Ella. It was almost like you were scatting with Ella. It was the most bizarre thing. So so I think that was the first thing for me back with I probably owe a lot to my parents, because if it wasn't for them playing me all that wonderful music, I think probably my life would have been on a different career path, definitely.
Incredible household to grow up in, to be, you know, have all of those musical influences. You said about pianists and things like that. Was that what you leaned towards kind of initially? What was your musical journey towards picking up a saxophone?
It was piano to start with, because I think, I mean, I'm quite small anyway. I've got tiny hands. So I think anything else was just not really considered back then. And my parents thought, you know, maybe let's just put her in for some piano lessons and see how it goes, which I loved. Mm-hmm. Obviously started school, got into secondary school. And then I was a bit bigger then. So I picked up the clarinet. Okay. By this point, I hadn't really thought too much about the saxophone. Mm-hmm. But when I was in the secondary school, there was as with all schools, you have the big band, the school band. And so I played clarinet in the band. But I always remember looking at the saxophonists and you could always hear them more than the clarinets. And I just remember thinking, I don't even know why I'm playing. Nobody can hear me back here. Like I just felt stuffed. And I'd look at the saxophones and I'd hear the sound, that lovely wall of sound that they were playing, thinking, I'd love to play one of those. And I remember mentioning it to my parents at the time, but they were like, look, you got your piano, you got your clarinet, you got GCSEs coming up. Like it's all too much. So it just was kind of shelved a little bit really. Mm. And right. So, because I did have so much on and I'm not the most academic person. I do have to work hard at things. It doesn't come easily. I think the only things that came a bit easy to me was my music and my art, really, I suppose, which is interesting because that's where I went to after that. I ended up going to art college, not to music college initially, which was really down to the careers advisor. And also, you know, when you get those careers books at school and they, you know, you look up the job title and then it tells you what you need to do to be that job. And I remember looking up musician and it just said, this is really only for the creme de la creme. And I remember speaking to the careers advisor as well. And really, it was kind of almost, look, let's not look at that as a career choice. Yeah. Let's move that to one side. Let's look at your art, you know, because with art, you could be a teacher, you can be a designer, there's all these options. So I ended up going to art college, did a foundation course in art and design, got accepted on a degree course in Birmingham, a fashion degree course. I was there 2 days.
No way.
And I realized immediately I have made a massive mistake. Like, I was just in this room with people I just had no connection with. And I just realized, I thought, I love art, but I loved more of the texture design, the surface pattern and that kind of style of art as opposed to fashion. Mm-hmm. But the course I ended up getting myself on was more of a fashion orientated course. I mean, I love fashion, but I don't love it that much and I can't make clothes. I mean, really, it's just not my area of expertise at all. So I remember calling my mum actually on the second day at uni and just saying, I don't know what I'm doing. And I actually broke down on the phone and she said, well, look, it's taken you. I mean, the patience that parents must have with children, you know, you do all these exams to get into the degree course of your choice. And then suddenly 2 days in, your child phones you up going, I don't know that I want to be here anymore. But bless her, she listened. She was very understanding. And she said, look, if you're really that unhappy, come home for a week, really think about it, but also think about the options of what you're going to do if you decide to drop out of this course. So that's what I did. I went back for a week. Also on that phone call, she actually said to me, have you thought about what you're going to do if you chuck this course in? And I remember saying, well, do you know what? I've always wanted to learn saxophone. I've always wanted to take up the saxophone. I mean, really, looking back at this conversation in hindsight, it must have been the most nuttiest conversation. My mum must have thought, oh my God, she's losing it. Like, where'd she get the saxophone from? But I don't know why. It just came out of the blue. But cut a very long story short, because I could waffle for ages about this part of my life. I did go back home. I considered my options and I decided to chuck the degree course in and take up the saxophone. And quite simply, it was the best thing I ever did. I remember getting these old jazz tapes and somehow I was able to record to cassette on this system I had. So I was able to play, I think I could play the jazz cassette on one side and then I could record myself playing to the jazz cassette on the other side on another cassette. And it was brilliant. So I could hear back. I pretty much taught myself how to improvise with the jazz on these, well, I guess it's probably the piano back when I was a child probably helped to give me a bit of a foundation with that, certainly musically. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't good. And actually, I recently got my hands on those tapes. I listened to them. And actually, in a few places, I'm like, ouch, that's like cringe. But anyway, from there, I got myself on an A-level music course and a jazz diploma course in Dorset at Weymouth College. And I was with such a great bunch of people. I had the most amazing lecturers. And from there, I got myself into Leeds College of Music on the jazz degree. Wow. And then pretty much everything, took off from there.
Yeah.
So it's quite an interesting zigzag of a path to get where I wanted to get to.
For that 2 days, you know, just to be, and then to make a real success of it. But God knows what was going through your parents' mind when you're having that conversation. It's like, I'm just going to quit this and learn the saxophone. But thank goodness you did. I mean, so from that point, when you're at Leeds as well, was it like, okay, I'm going to have a serious career in music, maybe towards the jazz spectrum?
Yes, definitely. I think that was the plan. I thought, right, I'll go and do my jazz degree in Leeds and then that would be 3 years. And then the plan was actually to move to London and do the postgrad at the Guildhall and just pretty much try and get myself on the London jazz scene. That was kind of the big dream. But whilst I was at college, I ended up bumping into this guy in the bar. I think he was towards the end of my first year at college, New Zealand guy. And he was a real character. He was quite avant-garde, quite wacky, quite way out there, not the usual muso. And he had this little gig that he had. It was a weekly residency in this little bar in Leeds that he would just go and jam with his DJ. Anyway, just to put you in the picture, I ended up walking through the college bar one day and I went to get something and he was at the bar and he's like, hey, it was Drew, his name. Hey, Laura, how's it going? Oh, good, blah, blah, blah. I was like, how are you? And he goes, actually not great. I've got to go back to New Zealand. I can't stay here. And we were just chatting for a bit and he went, such a shame. I've really started this little gig and it's just going really well and I'm going to have to get someone to do it. And then he looked at me and went, actually, maybe you would like to do it. Oh, well, what is it? He goes, pretty much I just turn up once a week and jam with this DJ who plays these old funk soul records. It's great. You don't know what you're going to play to, but it's completely different. And back then, I mean, I'm going back to, this would have been the end of 96, probably. Maybe in 96. So I hadn't seen any of this. I mean, I was still just coming up in, I guess, just seeing how you use an instrument within a band mm-hmm. situation, not opposed to improvising with a DJ. So I thought, okay, cool, I'll come down and have a listen and see what it's about. And I just remember falling in love with it. The music mm-hmm. the DJ was playing, I was just melting pretty much. And I just remember saying, yeah, I'd love this gig. I'll give it to me. I'd pay you to come down. But obviously I was a student. I didn't have that sort of money then. Yeah. And it was great. It was like 30 quid a week mm-hmm. Just to go down there for 2-3 hours, have a jam with the DJ. Oh, it was brilliant. And I from there, that's where this love grew of mm-hmm. kind of jamming with DJs. And I think the whole improvisation, the creativity that you can make from that situation. And from there, within a few weeks, I think another bar owner came in and went, oh, I wouldn't mind you in my bar. And then a club owner was like, oh, I wouldn't mind you in my club, actually. We'd do a week thing. Before I knew it, I had about 2-3 residencies on the go, which was amazing back then. I mean, especially when you're a student, you've got no money. So these little 20-30 quidders here and there are, you know, they're priceless.
The whole kind of improvisation thing, it's a very kind of jazz aesthetic, you know, that just kind of vibing and just kind of, you know, creating something that's kind of on the fly. And to bring I suppose discovering that you could do that with this other music that you, this new music that you were discovering as well, and create something new, I suppose that was a really good feeling.
I think it felt natural, actually. It just felt, I felt in hugely in my comfort zone mm-hmm. is actually what I felt. And the music I just loved. I mean, I love jazz as well, but the soul and the real feeling I could get out with this soul music, I just loved. And then from then it grew from funk, obviously, into dance music. And really that's where it kind of all initially started. I think that's where I first heard the first Head Candy Back to Love CD was sort mm-hmm. of 99. Was mm-hmm. it something like that?
So around then, yeah, I think so.
Around that time. Mm. And I remember getting that. I think Jazz FM came to Leeds and they did like a little pop-up convention and they had just loads of CDs they were giving away. And I just picked up just a bunch of CDs. Like, oh, that's cool, that's cool. And I put this Head Candy one going, oh, wow. I love this. This is great. And then I found out, oh, my God, they do parties. That's incredible. So, it's interesting how all these things lead. You have no idea, do you, back then? You're just kind of living every day. Mm-hmm. What throws itself in front of you. You do what you do. But you have no idea where eventually you're going to end up. It's mad. But all these little things that you do are hugely instrumental in getting you to the final goal, aren't they? Really?
Yeah. And I suppose there was that crossroads there as well in terms of, you know, do you follow that jazz specific route or do you go down this potentially newer, more interesting route? But, you know, it's a new kind of thing. There weren't that many people doing what you were doing at that point, I suppose.
No, there weren't. I'd never seen it before. I think there was a guy out in Ibiza back then maybe doing it. I can't remember his name now. Possibly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I didn't know anything about Ibiza then. I was really just in Leeds doing my thing. And I'm no doubt there was maybe some people doing it in London, but just at that point, I didn't know. But I think also it came down a little bit to money as well, because I remember I'd drive from Leeds to Manchester or Leeds to wherever. I'd do these really long drives on my jazz gigs for sort of like 20 quid. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't that long, when I say not that long ago. I mean, 15 years ago, something like that. 18 years ago. I can't remember when I left Leeds now, but I would be quite happy to drive across the Pennines one night to do a jazz gig for 20 quid. But then I'd get offered these club gigs for 100 quid and I'd think, hang on a minute, this doesn't stack up. Yeah. I don't get it. So eventually, when you're trying to make money and you're trying to earn a living, you do kind of also think, hang on, I think I need to maybe do more of these gigs and maybe less of these gigs. It was an interesting time though, because I do remember when I got myself into this style of music, there is always a bit of jazz snobbery within musicians and mm-hmm. certainly within students. And I always found a little bit, I felt like I was looked down upon a little bit for going down this route.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really care. I was having a great time. I was earning loads of money and it was brilliant. And actually I love what I'm doing because I love the music.
Yeah.
But you do, I think you get that with all genres of life, don't you? And certainly mm-hmm. with music, you have the people that really are the underground people or the extremely classical people that cannot, you know, listen or even comprehend anything else. And you do get that with jazzers as well. And mm-hmm. I did kind of get a little bit of snobbery at college about it, but I guess it didn't really mean anything, and it didn't really affect me because I just carried on what I was doing anyway. And thankfully it worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you said that you weren't really aware of Ibiza, you weren't really aware of that type of music at that stage. How did that, you know, tell me about leading up towards Ibiza or your first journey there, or just your, you know, your formative kind of clubbing experiences, you know, enjoying this new music that you discovered.
When I'd been invited to play a weekly residency not long after I'd got that first one in Leeds in a place called The Underground in Leeds. It was incredible. They had live bands there every day, real good vibe of good music, good funk music, good soul, good jazz, just everything that I loved was in that club. And I used to play there every Sunday afternoon between the two bands. There was the afternoon band and then there was the evening band, and then I would get up in between and sort of jam some stuff with the DJ. And one Sunday there had been a band on in the afternoon and the drummer was packing down his things, and he had some bits there he was bashing on. Drummers will be rolling their eyes at me now. Bits they were bashing on. as he was packing stuff down, he was kind of having a little tinker. And it sounded really cool. Anyway, it turned out this guy was Pav.
No way.
Who ended up, yeah, mm-hmm. Who obviously ended up doing what he did. But we were kind of like, wow, that kind of works, doesn't it? And the DJ was really digging it. And in the end, we said, look, why don't you come and join us on Sundays? And we had this little trio thing going on. So that's how that whole percussion and sax thing started for me anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, Pav loved it. We ended up doing quite a lot of stuff together as a duo back then.
Mm-hmm.
And there happened to be one evening in Leeds, there was a gig and I couldn't make the gig. I think I had a jazz gig somewhere else. For some reason, I couldn't make it, but Pav was on this gig. I wasn't. But anyway, as it would happen, the two Manumission brothers walked past mm-hmm. as he was playing, and they stopped. They were like, wow, we mm-hmm. love you. We love what you're doing. Blah, blah, blah. We'd love to fly you over and play Manumission in Ibiza. So cut a very long story short, that's exactly what Pav did. Every summer he would go over and play, I think it was weekly or bi-weekly for these mm-hmm. guys. Anyway, he came back and he went, Laura, you've not seen anything. You have to get to Ibiza. And I was like, yeah, look, I've got loads going on here, I haven't got time, blah blah blah. And mm-hmm. and I think I had a boyfriend at the time that wasn't too keen on me doing what I was doing anyway. It was just one of those friction type situations that mm-hmm. it was like, look, forget it, like I can't do this. In the end, he said, I've booked you a flight, you're coming. And that's the end of it. I've spoken to the Manumission guys. You can get up and have a play with me on the stage.
Wow. Yeah.
But you have to see this. So in the end, I went. And I do remember getting up on the stage and my jaw just hitting the floor, thinking, oh my God, I have never, ever seen anything quite like this in my life. Mm-hmm. It was just, my eyes were agog everywhere. And I was a very naive, young, 20 something year old anyway. Back then I wasn't very worldly wise at all. I think that's probably the little Dorset village girl coming out of me. I kind of believed everything, and so I saw things that night that I was like, wow, this is crazy. But I remember we were only there for like 2-3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Came back and I just remember thinking, I think I'm gonna have to go back there at some point. But it took 5 years before I did go back there. I ended up coming back and obviously life continued as it does with everyone where you are, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was eventually, that's right, Pav ended up playing for Head Candy. He ended up meeting Mark Doyle, started doing gigs with the guys. And then he would say to Mark, you need to check out this sax player. Like, she's really good. She'd be amazing on the gig. And Mark actually always used to say to him, can't stand sax players. They get right on my nerves. I really don't like them. I don't want a sax player on the gig. So that was how it kind of went on. Anyway, as luck would have it, we used to do this residency at a place called Lacorum in Barnsley. Mm-hmm. I think it was like once a month. And it turned out that the residency, the nights that we were on, Head Candy was also doing a night, but we were getting booked by the club, and also the club were booking Head Candy. So it was quite an interesting partnership. So anyway, one of these Head Candy nights, Mark happened to be on one of the gigs, and I was obviously there. And I do always say this to him, because it was a moment that I will never forget, when after the gig, he did actually come into the room and he got on his knees going, please come and play for us, which I thought was amazing. I was like, if only we had phones back then, as we do now, I'd have definitely videoed that. But yeah, and that was it. That was the beginning of the Head Candy partnership. That was back in 2004, I think. Yeah, 2005 was actually my very next time back to Ibiza after my initial intro to it. And that was to play the Head Candy closing party at El Divino in 2005. Yeah. So, and that was the kind of the beginning of my thing. I mean, actually, it was a terrible night. There was a horrific storm. There were buckets all over the club catching the drips. The canopies out the back were blowing a hoolie. I thought they were going to take off. And I had a horrendous migraine and had forgotten to bring any painkillers. So I spent most of the night actually in the dancers' room, curled up with this horrific headache. It must have, obviously, now I look back, must have been something to do with the storm or the pressure, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of woke up at about 5:30 in the morning. And I felt great. I was like, it's gone. I can actually play now. So I ended up getting on the stage, I think, for about the last hour or so. So that was my second intro to Ibiza. But then I decided the next year, 2006, I was going to come back for a couple of weeks for an actual, I'd say, a working holiday. It was kind of a holiday with another couple of girls. We got a big flat together. A little hotel room we shared. And I had a few gigs, just as a bit of pocket money, really, for that trip.
Yeah, yeah.
That was back in the day when In Bed With Space was going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the clubs were actually open 24 hours and obviously didn't shut at 6. I mean, yeah, God, crazy. But and then 2007, I said, right, I'm going to come back for 3 weeks. And then at the end of 2007, I remember saying, OK, I'm going to come back next year for the whole summer. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't know where I'm going to stay. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have to be here for a whole summer. And that, but actually at the end of 2007, I met Ben, who was already living here.
Right. Okay. How did that first meeting go?
It was quite an interesting one. He was playing in Bass Bar around Ibiza Port.
Mm-hmm.
He was the resident there every evening. And I happened to walk in there with my two girlfriends at the time. We were chatting, having a good time, walked in. He was playing and they were like, hi, Ben. And I was like, Ben? I was like, who's this guy? Why do I not know him? Like, he's a DJ as well. It was ridiculous. And they were like, you don't know Ben?
Mm.
Like, this is Ben Santiago. And I was like, oh, hi. And then we sort of immediately kind of had a bit of a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized, he went, you're Laura, aren't you? You're lovely Laura. You're the sax girl. And I was like, yeah. And then it suddenly dawned on me, we had a mutual Spanish friend called Jose, who, funnily enough, he'd been telling me about this English guy in Ibiza, saying, you two would really get on, you really need to meet. And he'd also been telling Ben about me, this English girl who plays the saxophone, you'd really get on, you should really meet.
Yeah.
And it kind of just hit us. We were like, oh my God, you're the guy that you're Jose's friend.
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, oh, no way. And then we chatted for a bit and it was an immediate connection. And then interestingly enough, that next week we kind of kept bumping into each other. He would be DJing somewhere. I'd walk in and he'd be there. I'd be like, oh my God, it's you again. And we just ended up chatting and we just hit it off and we kind of swapped numbers. I was obviously going back to England for the rest of the summer, but then I was going to come out for the closing party for Head Candy the end of that year. And pretty much as soon as I landed, he messaged me and went, do you fancy going out for dinner this evening before the gig?
Mm-hmm.
So we did, and it was lovely. I mean, yeah, it was the beginning of definitely something there. And then we kind of hit it up. I think he came over to London in, was it the January of 2008?
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to London and had a lovely day or two with him there. And then I think that's when we realised there's something going on here. Yeah. And he said, look, why don't you come out to Ibiza for a couple of weeks in February? And that was almost like the trial period. I think if we could live together for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. we knew that yeah. it would work. And that then I would come back and we'd get a place together for mm-hmm. that yeah. summer of 2008. And it did, thankfully. We got really well. We fell in love and the rest is history. And we got a little pad in Ibiza town in 2008, which was brilliant. He was doing his little gigs. So he'd zip about on his scooter and do what he was doing. I had my weekly residency with Head County El Divino, which was amazing. I used to catch the little boat across the ferry to yeah. get, you know, the little to get to the club. I mean, it was a great summer that. And then yeah. actually there was another great club in Ibiza town, not so much a club, it was more a live music venue called Teatro Pereira. Mm-hmm. And they used to have they had a house resident band every night that would play just covers, really, rock, pop, soul, funk, all sorts. And the musicians were incredible. Like everyone that the guy picked to form this band, they were outstanding musicians. Yeah. And I remember going in there and just loving it. And I went, I'd love to come and jam. So I actually ended up coming in, playing in there, I think, 2-3 nights a week as well. So it was quite a cool summer, yeah. 2008. It was a gentle introduction to Ibiza.
And when was so at that point, you were on kind of separate paths in terms of, like you said, Ben was doing his DJ thing and you were doing your own thing as well. Where was it decided, like, okay, were you kind of circling around each other thinking, should we combine our talents and do what I've been doing, you know, in Leeds and throughout that, you know, vibing with other DJs?
Yeah.
Were you a bit frightened of making that leap, or was it always just a natural progression between the two of you?
Do you know what? I think it was a bit of an organic thing. I think both of us got offered a gig. I think it was a private event at a villa party in Ibiza by an agent here. And they said, look, what would be really nice if Ben, you could play, and Laura, if you could just play some saxophone through dinner, that would be really nice. Mm. So I think that was the first time we actually ever played together. And it really worked. And I think it was only when we did it that we then realized, wow, we could really make something of this, because we know each other so well, we kind of almost can... Instead of this turning into a bit of an improv session, like it usually does when you turn up, you don't know what the DJ is going to play, you jam along and you kind of hope it goes all right. Mm. We can actually talk about the set beforehand. And do you like that tune? Do you like that tune? How about playing to this one? And so almost that was the initial beginning where we thought, gosh, we could do this together. Mm-hmm. Like actually we could work together. But it was odd how we hadn't really thought about it up until that point. It was only getting booked to do this event that made us realize actually we could do this together. And actually there was another one I think we got around that time, another private, I think it was a private birthday party that ended up, I mean, there were all sorts of people there. And also Domenico Dolce from Dolce & Gabbana, who happened to come up and introduce himself. I mean, gosh, it's just the people on my fashion degree back in the day would be turning in their graves now.
Exactly.
You don't know who Domenico Dolce is. I mean, I knew Dolce & Gabbana, but I don't know the faces of people. Mm-hmm. I'm probably the worst person. I could be introduced to whoever and I haven't got a clue who they are. But he came up and he was introduced himself. I'm so-and-so from Dolce & Gabbana. I think you're amazing. I'd love you to come and play. We've got some shows coming up. And I was like, oh, that would be wonderful. Yeah, okay, thank you. And then he came up at the end and he said, do you have a card? Like, remember, I'm so-and-so from Dolce & Gabbana. And I think he repeated it because I think he thought, have you not got a card?
I missed the Dolce.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, I love it. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll go and get you a card. And I just got a business card and I gave him the card. And then I remember saying to Ben, I went, he repeated his name again. I said, I think he's someone quite important, actually. And we went back and then, of course, we Googled Dolce & Gabbana. We were like, oh, bloody hell. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't swear, but oh my God, I can't believe it. It's Dolce & Gabbana. It's Domenico Dolce. But so from that was quite, that was a good start as well for both of us, because yeah. we ended up getting booked to play for their boutiques in London, in China. We did a bit of in Italy, we did a few fashion weeks. So again, it kind of started that whole initial idea, I guess, of working together.
Yeah.
So yeah, and from then, I guess, yeah, it spiraled.
Yeah,
there, I suppose.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm thinking of, we all have lived through lockdown, you know, being cooped up with our other halves and whatever. You know, some people probably listening will think they'd find it really challenging to work with their other half, especially over the past 18 months we've had. How is it for you guys? Is it a breeze just because you're so well connected to each other? Or is it, you know, a bit bumpy here and there in terms of managing conflict, or I like this, I want to play this, I'm not sure about it, I can't do anything with it? How do you work those things out and work together?
We do actually get on. We get on very well. I don't think we rarely have arguments, actually. I mean, I guess here, quite often, Ben will be in one room on his laptop, I'll be in the other room on my laptop. So we do still quite live separate lives, and yet we come together for sort of lunches and dinners and whatnot during the day. But we do really get on. We have a good understanding of each other. I think we can tell when the other one needs a bit of space and we just give them a wide berth. but we do kind of really understand and respect each other very well. We're very fortunate. We say nearly every day to each other how lucky we are that we met each other. Because we do get each other, we do understand each other, and it's incredible that we can actually work together. I mean, yes, you're right, sometimes it can get intense when you're working and you're living and with your partner. You're pretty much spending 24/7 with them, and it can get intense. But I think you if you're both mature enough and understand the situation, you can give each other space when you feel the other person needs space, and it works. I think we're a really good team, actually. I think when it comes to music, it works well as well. Ben obviously gets sent lots of promos as a DJ, and he listens to music. I think he's got now an idea of what I like to play to, but also he has to like it as well. And now and again, yeah, I will admit there'll be a track that I'm like, oh my God, I love this track, and I'll play it to Ben, and he's like, what? I'm not playing that. So I'm like, all right, so we'll bin that, and vice versa. He'll come to me with something and go, wow, this track's doing really well. It's getting a lot of hype and blah, blah, blah. And I'll listen to it and I just think, well, I can't add anything to that. I can't add any sax to that. I'd actually ruin it. So no, I don't really want to play to it. So it has to work for both of us. But quite often the system is he'll get sent promos. If he thinks it's good, he'll send it to me. Go, how do you feel about playing on this? I'll have a listen, have a little jam. If it works, I'm like, yeah, do you know what? This is cool. We could play to this. And then he'll bung it in his little set list on his laptop, and then he can move stuff over to his USB for gigs. But I mean, one thing that he's very adamant about and will not do is do a planned set. That's something that he really will not do. He says, I'm not going to go to that point where we turn up, to every gig, and we play exactly the same track in exactly the same order. And he said, I just can't do that. He said, you know, and I do understand that. We do sometimes have a battle with that, because of course for me that would be fantastic, because I would know when you're out front and you're performing and you're giving it all the, you know, the live thing and the lights are on you, you need to have that inner confidence to know, right, what's the next track going to be? When is it going to get dropped? I'm already with the key. I know what it is and I know what the riff is and I know where to play, where not to play. So it's quite nice having that luxury. But I fully understand where he's coming from in the, you know, wherever you go, you have a different crowd. Sometimes you can have a young crowd and they want more contemporary stuff. Sometimes you have an older crowd, they want more classics. So you do have to have a kind of bit of flexibility. You can't kind of go around and play exactly the same set. It's quite nice to just bend it now and again. You know, what we would play at Ibiza Rocks is not what we would play at Mambo, for example. It would be, you've just got a different crowd. So it's, so sometimes we might have the odd little battle over a track, but normally we unite in love.
are there any moments where, you know, I suppose it sounds like he's very much in charge of that side of that side of things. Are there any moments when you're both together on stage and you're like, come on, Ben, stick this one. I think we should stick this one on. And he has to make a choice.
Yeah, I've done that a couple of times. I'll go over to him if I'm listening on the side and I think, oh, do you know what that would do? I see maybe some of the girls react to something and I think, do you know what, they would love that tune. And I'll go up and I'll go, have you got such and such? And he kind of looks at me as if to say, look, who's DJing here? I'm like, I know, I'm just saying. But I do love it if he then plays it and it goes off. I think, yes. Yeah, but no, he's actually very, very good. He's very good at reading the crowd and seeing where they want to go. Yeah. So it's good. I mean, yeah, it's good. We work well together, I think. I mean, we did have a battle for a while with the whole Jubel thing by Kling Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Because obviously that all started back in 2014 when a video of me at Ocean Beach playing it happened to go viral. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody jumped on it thinking that I actually was the saxophonist in the track, which of course I'm not.
Yeah.
It's the amazing Snake Davis who does the saxophone in that. But of course, after that went viral, Kling Gandhi actually got in touch with me directly and said, look, I love all this. Do you fancy coming and doing some gigs with me? So that's, I think maybe people saw us working together and thinking, you know, it kind of all started there. But so that was a big track in our recent history, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And we obviously had to include that in all our sets for quite a while. And then I think after about 3-4 years, we started seeing a bit of negativity on the internet, because unfortunately there's lots of positives about having a video go viral or people seeing you play something. But then the negatives of that are you get the trollers that come on going, oh, here she is, one trick pony. She can only play this one song. She can't play anything else. So once we started seeing those comments, Ben said, right, that's it. We're taking Jubel out of the set. We're not going to play it anymore, because everyone always gets their phones out when you play it. Because, of course, they want that memory on their phone. But, of course, that's the one that they upload to the internet. Yeah. And, of course, that's the one that people who don't come to the gigs and don't see that actually I can play other tunes, they just see that video and think, all right, you know, that's all she can play. So, well, we took it out of the set for a while, but we realised that was a very bad mistake, because people would just be screaming at us from the dance floor, Jubel, when are you going to play Jubel? And I'd look at Ben and I'd sort of like tentatively say to him, you're gonna have to play Jubel, and he's like, I'm not playing it, no, we're not going there. And there was a few gigs where we didn't do it, but actually it broke my heart, because there was some girls on some of the gigs that were like, we've just come to see you play that, you know. And I thought, for goodness sake, for the sake of 3 minutes of a track, can, you know, we need to play this. So we actually decided, you know, it doesn't matter if those videos go up, what trollers say, can't be bothered, not reading negative stuff anymore. We're just going to add it to the set, because they're paying to come and see us and they want us to play this track. It's as simple as that. You have to give them what they want, because ultimately if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing.
Yeah, we had I had a very similar conversation with Matt from Medusa, one of our previous episodes, about Piece of Your Heart. A very similar thing in terms of them performing, and you know, he was like, even if I've played it in the set two or three times sometimes. He was like, that will have to be the last tune because otherwise you'll get that almost like a negative reaction that you haven't played it. It's a very difficult line to balance, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You have to. But it's funny how you go through this little journey to get there, but you realise in the end you just have to. But I actually love it.
It's a banger. I mean, you and Ben, between yourselves, you have produced quite a few anthems as well. I mean, I'm thinking of Just Want Your Body and Summer Love. I mean, what's the feeling when you're playing your own material on stage? Is the crowd reaction, is it elevated because it's your own, or are you just happy to be giving, like sharing this music?
I think it of course makes you feel, it's a lovely reward when people sing back the lyrics of your song and they're singing back the horn line. I don't think there's anything quite like that. And yeah, it means a lot when they request those certain ones. I mean, it's funny. Yeah, Summer Love, we don't play that often, but it's quite interesting how many times that gets requested. I mean, I don't think, in all honesty, the last few years, Ben and I have been that productive in the studio. We haven't, we did quite well with Just Want Your Body and Summer Love, but then pretty much at the point of those coming out, we just had so many gigs and we were on the road constantly. We didn't have 5 minutes to start an idea, get it finished and get it released. Yeah. We quite often would take the January and February off in the year and we'd start the ideas, but they'd get so far and then touring would start and they never get finished. So actually, I mean, coming onto the whole COVID thing this past year, it's been quite a blessing in some ways because it's made us just ground ourselves, stay at home, get in the studio and just start going back to some of these ideas with a lot less pressure, certainly for time. You know, we can just sit there, listen to them and let things grow naturally, as opposed to thinking, oh my God, we've got to start touring in 2 weeks. We haven't got, we need to get this done now. And as soon as you start applying that pressure to yourself, you might as well forget it. For me, definitely, I'm not great with stuff like that. I just feel like I need to get into the zone, enjoy it, be freely creative instead of putting this pressure on. But yeah, so actually we're quite excited about this next year because we've been working quite hard in the studio this last year. So we've got a few little belters up our sleeve. So can't wait to actually start getting out and playing them once everything starts going back. We've got some nice ideas.
Good.
We just need to get them finished. We are quite we kind of start the idea and it starts going really well and we're like, yeah, brilliant, we've pretty much got that, and then we'll move on to something else, then we start getting something else, and then all of a sudden we've got this army of unfinished tracks that we need to, so this is what we're kind of trying to focus on now. We're kind of going back to each one and going, right, let's just get this finished, let's get this to a stage where we're happy, it's ready to be mixed and mastered, bosh, done, next. Let's get that one finished. So that it's kind of a very methodical process we need to go to, but we just get very easily distracted, both of us. And I think we're just living such a lovely life here that there never seems to be this huge pressure on us to, come on, you got to get tracks finished. So it's nice. Life is good.
Life is good. I mean, yeah, living in Ibiza, I can't imagine life being much better, really. You know, we've already talked about your first visit and your journey towards moving there. When you decided to make that move, did you, like, permanently, was this, okay, this is going to be the most important thing I can do if I want to exist in the dance music scene? Did you think that it's absolutely crucial that you live in Ibiza, or was it just, I love this island and, you know, I can do my work anywhere in the world, but I can still live here?
Yeah, I'm more the latter, I would say. When I moved here, I just realised how beautiful this place was, and just the air quality, the way of the style of living, it was very relaxed. There was no urgency, no stress. I mean, on one hand, that's lovely. But on the other hand, you know, once you do move here and you do have to get jobs done, it can be extremely frustrating with their very manana attitude. And the bureaucracy that goes into it as well, trying to get forms done and this and that. But I think initially, of course, I loved the music and I realized that, wow, these gigs were incredible out here. You're playing to such a diverse audience that you're not going to get this anywhere else in the world. That's what I felt at the time. Obviously, I met Ben. Ben was a massive factor in the fact that he had moved here, I think, 2 years before I came out, and he had already stated this was his home. Like he was so happy here. Yeah. And so I thought, well, if we're going to be together, he's clearly not moving back to England. So I've only got one choice here. I'm going to have to move to Ibiza, which is not a problem. And actually, I can't remember the first year. Oh, the first year probably would have been 2009, because we were quite quick. Once we initially got together, we had our first summer together, 2008 here. Mm. And then we got offered a great gig in Mexico, in Tulum, in the February of 2009. And it was whilst we were there that Ben proposed. Mm-hmm. And then pretty much by April, we'd bought a house. I'd sold my house in Leeds. Ben was looking to buy a house as well. So we put our money together, and then we got our little place here in 2009. So pretty much I committed before I really even thought whether it was going to work or not, work-wise. It was a bit of a risk, actually. I mean, thankfully it paid off. But I did think, right, okay, I'm going to do this first winter and see if promoters are happy to fly me from Ibiza mm-hmm. to wherever to do the gigs. Mm-hmm. And if they are, then I've got my answer and phew, a sigh of relief. If not, then I'm going to have to seriously think about the future, because I can't obviously just sit here and start living a life of retirement in my 30s. It's ridiculous. But thankfully, yeah, promoters were. They were happy to pay the extra flights, and it wasn't too bad. About that time, actually, was when Ibiza started doing direct flights. I think that's when the Ryanair thing kicked off. Mm-hmm. And they were doing those winter direct flights, which was fantastic, because then at least you didn't have to do the double legger going via Madrid or Barcelona. Yeah, so thinking about it, definitely I moved here more for the quality of life and the beauty of the island, and obviously because I'd met my future husband as well, and he was so happy here, and we thought, you know what, this could be a really nice, contented life. And I mean, just thankfully, music is a huge part of our lives. It's our career, it's our work, our livelihood, and it's the style of music that we're involved with is, you know, massive. Yeah. So it's like the heart of it.
What was it like on the island in 2020 during the pandemic? Was it everything just blissfully slowed down and no tourism, or, you know, just take us through that feeling?
Very strange. Driving through San Antonio in the middle of August was very surreal. It was obviously scorchio temperature, but it looked like you were in the middle of January here. There was just not a soul about. You know, normally at sunset time when people are walking down to see the sunset, it's just nobody. Yeah. It was like a ghost town. I mean, I didn't get over to Playa del Bosa, but I did hear from a lot of people it was pretty much the same there. Mm-hmm. It was a very surreal experience, but actually quite nice as well. Yeah. And I think the island really needed this. I think it needed a bit of a breather. I mean, it goes through so much every summer. So it was quite nice that, you know, the planes stopped flying and the people didn't come and the beaches could breathe and the oceans could breathe. You know, the yachts weren't churning out their rubbish into the ocean as they do every July, August. It was quite nice. And actually, I don't know about this summer, but it's kind of looking that it won't be too much different this summer either, which I think is a gift to the island, really. I mean, it gives so much to everyone every year. I think it's the least we can do is just, you know what, give it a bit of a breather. Yeah. Let it just recoup a bit.
Yeah, there's a, you know, it's like Glastonbury as well. There's a reason that every few years they'll have like a fallow year to let the land and the farmyard recover. You know, why not be able to do it? Well, you're never going to be able to do it officially with Ibiza, but a pandemic put paid to that. It's fantastic that it does have that benefit of now being able to recover.
Nature maybe stepped in.
2 years in a row. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
You just mentioned the season. And I agree as well. I think that, you know, this season will be curtailed somewhat and there'll be some kind of restrictions in place. Whatever those are, we're yet to see. But what do you think... how do you think clubbing institutions on the island might change during this upcoming season? Do you think there'll be socially distanced things or more like live streaming things or maybe clubs remaining closed? What do you reckon?
I mean, it's really difficult to say because it's changing all the time, isn't it? The rules and regulations and this pandemic, the virus, it's all over the place. You know, what you think is the set path all of a sudden can, you know, make a dog leg one side and you're off down another path and you're like, oh, right, okay, so what we thought was going to happen now isn't going to happen. Or it could be the reverse. You know, you think that's not going to happen and suddenly we're back on track. I mean, funnily enough, yesterday during the day, I was having a bit of a conversation with someone that it's not looking that rosy. And then last night I hear news that the Balearics, I think, are going to open up because their numbers are so low. They're going to open up to the UK as long as people that come from the UK have had a negative test or vaccine or whatever. You know, within 24 hours, or no, that was in a day. What I was saying in the morning was completely different to what I was saying in the evening. So I have no idea what's going to be happening in June. I think we just don't know at the moment. I mean, I think clubbing wise, open air venues will probably open. I mean, already restaurant terraces here have opened. And I think they're going to start increasing their hours maybe in a couple of weeks, something like that. I'm not quite sure exactly when, but it looks like, you know, slowly they're opening up. But I think the likes of the Ibiza Rocks and the Ocean Beaches, they will be able to open because, of course, they're an open air venue. I'm not so sure about dance floors. I think that's taking it a step too far, maybe at the moment. Who's to know, though, by September? It's quite possible, you know, if numbers are great all around Europe, which I don't know that they will be because they can't seem to get their act together with the vaccines, but the UK is smashing it. It's incredible. But if, you know, we can keep numbers down, then maybe we might be allowed a dance floor by September. But I think from what I'm seeing with venues, I think maybe they're filling more their dance floors with day beds, trying to keep people that come over in their bubbles. Indoor clubs at the moment are a no-no, definitely. There's no sign of them on the horizon. So I don't know. I mean, again, if things change by September, they might be able to, but again, we just don't know, do we? It's so difficult to try to predict. It's such an unpredictable time. I think certainly for this year, we're not back to norm. Definitely not. It's going to be still a bit restrained, a little bit held back. But I don't know. I mean, you know, looking at England, they're selling out festival tickets in hours. and I'm hearing they're not socially distanced either. So I'm like, wow, it's almost like, my goodness, I can't get my head around it.
Fingers crossed. And I just mentioned about live DJ sets and streaming during this pandemic period. Have you and Ben participated in any of that, and what's that been like for you? Or have you tried to keep it at arm's length because you want an audience interaction?
We did actually do a couple of live streams last year, I think, when it all started kicking in. And then I think we did another one for New Year's Eve. We went over to the Beach Star and set up a little phone there and got the lights going and had a bit of a New Year's Eve party, the two of us. do you know what is difficult? There's no question about it. There is nothing like being in the room with the crowd and high-fiving them and seeing the joy on their faces and seeing them smile, seeing them laugh, seeing them cry sometimes, singing at the top of their voices, arms in the air. I miss that so much. And I really can't wait for that to come back. And I think I'm going to have to be a lot more patient because I don't think it's any time immediately soon, but I just hope we get there at some point. Because there's nothing quite like it. For me, the magic is, maybe this takes me right back full circle to how it all started. It's the jamming, it's the improv, it's the whole live feel. I want to say living life on the edge. I'm not living life on the edge, but playing life on the edge, quite literally. A record comes on, you jam it. It's always going to sound different. You never quite know. It's not going to be a repeat of something before. And I just feel this whole live element is something I've definitely missed. To the point, I'll be very honest, I've hit some pretty low points in the last year where I've even questioned whether to go down a different path, which is very strange considering that saxophone has always been my life. But I've not had the passion to pick up the saxophone. It's odd because I've seen many other musicians and vocalists and whatnot, they they're loving doing the live stream thing. They're loving to play. And actually that at the minute, the social media is your shop window.
Yeah.
But it's funny. For me, I almost need to be with the people, and I struggle quite a lot with this way of kind of reaching out to people. So I think I've got a lot of learning to do and a lot of evolving to do, because I think looking into the future, that is where, that's where we are going. And I can't always rely on just being with people and hugging people and playing live with people. And so, yeah, it's been quite tough, because a few times I've thought, if that doesn't come back, for me, the magic of what I do has gone.
Yeah.
Actually, I love music and I love playing, as in, you know, getting on the piano, making some chords and maybe writing some bits. But performing, there is nothing compared to performing in a live venue with people there, as opposed to doing a live stream. But it's odd. I mean, I say that because, you know, then we'll do a live stream and you see the comments and people are like, thank you so much for doing that. I've got you playing in my lounge, or we're out in the garden having a few drinks. And it's like, wow, you know, yeah,
no,
you are still doing it. People are out there. But it's funny being here in our little house in this little island in the middle of nowhere. You just feel quite isolated. You feel like everything's just come to a grinding halt. It's mad.
And yeah, it's heartening to know that there's an audience there. I mean, I think maybe the future will hold some kind of streaming element combined with the live element. So when you are playing live somewhere, that will be then the people that couldn't make it there could perhaps participate at home somehow, I hope.
Something like that could be
the future. And now we move on to the playlist, the five tracks that we get all of our guests to choose for our Spotify Perfect playlist. And we always want to start off with a catalyst tune, a track that originally got you into dance music or house music. And this one for you, it might not necessarily have a sax on it, but it's definitely got one of the most recognisable piano hooks in house music on it. What is it, and why have you chosen it?
Well, interestingly enough, I know I was going through this yesterday. It was, and I don't think I've written it down fully enough, but I do know that I chose Playing with Knives, I think, didn't I? Playing with Knives by
Bizarre Inc.
Crumbs, sorry. I didn't write it. I was going through it yesterday. I listened to so much music yesterday. My head was just all over the place. But I wanted to go back to a time where I was a bit stuck, actually, between Playing with Knives, Bizarre Inc., or Move Your Body by Expansions, because I also do remember there were two times of hearing both these tracks, but in the end I went with Playing with Knives, because every time I hear it I just feel so euphoric and I just want to get on a dance floor and just lose myself. I think it's just that piano, and of course, coming from the piano background, I love those piano chords, and I used to always try and imitate those chords on the piano when I was a kid. I think it was a friend of mine at school. She got dropped off to my house by her boyfriend at the time. She was much more older and grown up than me. And he had this music blaring out of his car. And it was Playing with Knives and also Move Your Body by Expansions. And I remember hearing these going, what is this music? Like, this is incredible. Like, you know, and of course he was telling me, and I never forgot it. It was just imprinted in my brain. And then eventually I started going clubbing and it was, you know, DJs were playing it. And I think it was at that point that I thought, wow, you know, they'd play this music and I just had this inner urge. I couldn't kind of sit still. I just had to get on the dance floor. And then they'd come back to, I don't know, some mainstream pop something. And I'd be like, okay, yeah, fine. Or rock. I never really got rock, interestingly enough. It was more the dance, funk, soul. Like that would get me on the dance floor. So that's why I chose Playing with Knives, Bizarre Inc., because it takes me back to that first time when I was, early teens, I think. Was I? Yeah, early 90s.
Yeah.
Brilliant time for music, actually, then, I think, the early 90s.
Yeah, everything changing so much with all the technology and the influences and the sampling and everything. Yeah, it's such a great, creative time, definitely. And we've already, a floor filler, we've already kind of mentioned it as well, had a bit of chat about it. What have you chosen? And if there's anything more to add to what you've already said about it.
I think there is no other tune that, at this stage of my life, that I could say it would have to be Jubel by Klingandy. You know, when we're on a gig, that track just erupts the venue. So that is unquestionably, at the moment, probably the biggest floor filler that I would play on a gig. that if everyone was outside smoking or whatever, we'd put Jubel on and, oh, the fags are out, the drinks are gone, they're on the dance floor, the phones are out. It's brilliant. So, yeah, definitely, that's the floor filler.
That's what you want. That's what you want. Yeah, when someone's put down their drink, that's
you know,
a good
it's,
one.
It's a good one.
It's on. Cool. And we had chat about a sunsetter. We had some back and forth on this because this is particularly interestingly that this is seems to always be the one that, you know, people choose and someone's maybe already chosen it, particularly in the sunsetter. So I always like to try and say, okay, well, some that's already in the playlist. If you're fine with that, we can talk about it. But if not, you've got a chance to choose something else. And then, you know, third time lucky, we got to where we got to. And
yeah. Yeah. Didn't we? Brilliant. Yeah, I know. So, my first choice, obviously, was the At the River by Groove Armada.
I think Norman Cook chose that for the playlist.
Did he?
Yeah, so, you know, that makes it okay, yeah. I suppose.
To me, it is. Like, that comes on, the trombone comes in and the strings, and just that's it. You're sat at Mambo watching the sunset for me. It's a deep sigh of satisfaction when you hear that tune come on. So, that was my first one. The next one, when I realised that had gone, I thought, right, it's got to be Everybody Loves the Sunshine by Roy Ayres. I mean, who I love. I saw him live and I absolutely, God, he's just gets me. I can't stop moving to him. But of course, that had gone. So in the end, I thought, right, I'm going to have to choose something that I know nobody is going to have got this one. So I came back eventually with Stan Getz's version of Moonlight in Vermont. I mean, there are two versions that he's played to this, so it has to be this one particular version, which I think is off the Reflections album, isn't it?
Yes,
we found. But it's one of those saxophone, I mean, Stan Getz is one of my favorite saxophonists anyway. He just plays with so much feeling and soul and gentleness, you know. You get some saxophonists that, you know, blare it out and have aggression, and he just has this lovely lyrical way of playing. And his version of Moonlight in Vermont is this particular one. How he's redone the chords for the first part is stunning, and actually it kind of makes me well up a little bit. It's lovely. So I thought, yeah, you know what, if I had a nice cheeky cocktail in my hand and I was watching the sunset, I'd definitely be happy listening to this.
And you know, you just mentioned welling up as well. The next one is the Tearjerker. Any track that makes you well up beyond Stan Getz? What have you chosen?
Well, I eventually chose Another Star by Stevie Wonder. Actually, anything that Stevie Wonder sings, I just burst into tears. He just moves me to another level. I just have to hear him sing a couple of words and that's it. I've melted. Ben actually, as a surprise present a few years ago, bought tickets for us to fly to New York and see him perform in Madison Square Gardens. And it was incredible. I mean, it was quite funny because I did spend the whole concert just crying. I mean, I was just not, you know, sillily crying, but just I was so moved by everything he did, his singers, his band, him. And he was just there. I could see him. I could put my hand out and, well, I couldn't. I wasn't that close and touching, but he was there. And by the end of the concert, I actually felt quite ashamed because I had eyes like golf balls. They were all red, tear stained. And we were chatting to these people next to us. And I just thought, God, they must think I'm an absolute weirdo. But he's just something else, Stevie. His voice is every time I hear him, I will just cry. I can't help it. I just do. So I chose Another Star because it's a very upbeat, uplifting tune, but actually the lyrics are quite deeply sad. So I thought that was quite a good choice from his huge catalogue of songs to use as my tearjerker.
Perfect choice. Great. I did see him a couple of years ago in Hyde Park as well, and the man is just a legend, league of his own. He's being supported by Lionel Richie. Like, when you've got Lionel Richie as your support act, you know you're pretty good. And okay, a last tune. The crowd are asking for one more. What do you stick on the deck?
This is another tricky one. This is why I was getting myself in such a tiz yesterday looking at all the tunes. I was like, there's just too much to choose from. I don't know what to do here. To try and limit it to one tune is so hard. If we're on a gig and we haven't already played Jubel, we would probably do Jubel because, of course, it is the floor filler. It's really what they want to hear. So that would be the one more. If we have already played that, we quite often like to, especially at Mambo, take it down a different path and just play something a bit different. Come away from, you know, full intense house for a moment and maybe do something like All Night Long by Lionel Richie, or Teardrops by Womack and Womack, Everywhere by Fleetwood Mac. Then I was stuck because another personal favourite of mine is Somebody Else's Guy by Jocelyn Brown, because I just hear that come in and I'm like, yes, and all the girls get their handbags in a little circle and we're on the dance floor and having an amazing time. So I was really stuck. Has anyone requested any of these yet?
No, none of those.
So I could go for
anyone. Any of those, yeah.
I'm torn actually between Everywhere by Fleetwood or Jocelyn. Should have thought about this before. What shall I do? People, what shall I do? Help me out here. I don't know what to do. I mean,
you don't have to decide right now. What you could do,
okay,
we could leave it hanging and I could email you in like June when this is going to go out, and then you could decide and you'll have 10 more
I could
to choose
decide
from.
Then amazing. Yeah, exactly, that's the only problem. Do you know what, I'm going to actually make a choice now. And the reason I'm going to choose this one is because we actually saw these guys perform, was it 2019? I think they came and did a concert at Wembley, Fleetwood Mac. I'm going to go with Everywhere Fleetwood Mac, because when they started playing this, I mean, the stadium erupted, of course it would do. So I have a very, very good memory of that. And actually also there's been a lot of documentaries on them the last year through COVID I've been watching. So yeah, for that alone, Jocelyn, I'm sorry, I'll come back to you another day. But for my final last tune, I'm going to go Everywhere Fleetwood Mac.
Brilliant choice. Yeah, when that first tinkle comes in from the very beginning, it is spine tingling.
Yeah, and the chorus. I mean, it's just so happy, isn't it? And elating.
Yeah, so one final question. We always wrap up with this question, which is, we are house culture and you are part of the culture and the scene. What does it mean to you, the whole culture of the scene, and what has it brought you in your life, and what excites you about it, about the future?
Oh, that's an interesting question. House culture is my life, I guess. God, I need to think about this one.
I tell you what, you could just sum it up the way you just said it. Is if it's your life and that's a summation, then that's enough. Maybe
I don't need to go into a great long description. I mean, I'm very good at going into long descriptions, but I just think it brings so much joy and happiness to so many people. I think it unites people. Yeah, it just brings so much positivity. It's certainly unknowingly brought positivity to me, and it's changed my life around. And certainly without it, I'm not quite sure where I would be or what I would be doing right now. So yeah, it's I'm going to go back to exactly what my first few words were. House culture is my life.
Perfect. Well, that's brilliant place to end on. No, that's really fantastic. Thank you for taking part in the podcast.
Thank you so much for asking me. Absolute pleasure. Big love. See you later. Bye-bye.
House culture.
That was great, wasn't it? Lovely Laura, well and truly living up to her name there. Thanks so much for taking part, and to you for listening. Now, I know you're going to dig this, because Laura is currently giving back to her fans by performing a series of sax jams that you can view on her Instagram. Honestly, they're awesome, and they should hopefully be enough to satisfy anyone's appetite for a bit of sax alongside their house music. However, if you prefer your music more live than virtual, make sure you keep your eyes peeled for some very special gigs from Laura coming up in the UK. Fingers crossed for those. You also heard Laura select some incredible tracks for our ever-growing House Culture Perfect playlist that you can find on Spotify. This epically eclectic selection of tunes has taken submissions from every single one of our previous podcast guests. Seek it out by searching for House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify, stick it on shuffle, and turn it up loud. With that as your soundtrack, please help support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and rating or reviewing us on Apple. We've had some fantastic feedback already, so if you say something good, it will not only help us to continue to create these episodes that you love listening to, it could also get you a shout out on a future one as well. This time around, I'm calling out to one of the voices of house music, the supremely talented Ms. B, who got in touch on Instagram to say that she loved our chat with Berlin-based techno icon Anya Schneider. Thanks so much for the positive comments, B. I hope you're enjoying the rest of this season so far as well. And if you want to join us at House Culture from wherever you might be in the world right now, please hit up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. Not only will you be kept fully informed about the podcast, you'll also get connected with other beat lovers from across the globe. And finally, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.